Good morning. I'm Donna Coltharp. I represent Mr. Duran Caldera in the case before you. At issue in this case is a sworn affidavit. It's an affidavit that was taken in connection with an investigation into document fraud. It's an affidavit that was kept with the police report that that document fraud case involved, and it's an affidavit that was kept in the record of investigation surrounding that document fraud case. It's a record that ultimately helped lead to a criminal prosecution and conviction for document fraud. And it's a record that was introduced against Mr. Duran at his criminal trial.
I misunderstood. I thought one of the briefs said it was an investigation, but there was a prosecution of the midwife.
It was not a prosecution of Mr. Duran or anyone in his family, but the midwife who is mentioned in the statement was prosecuted and convicted.
How old was Duran, the defendant here, when that report was generated?
He was about 6 when the report was generated. It was kept in, and after the prosecution, my understanding is that it was then put into the A files of both of his parents. Mr. Duran.
Is it possible that a document can be a dual purpose document?
It is, and the Supreme Court is taking a case this term on multi-purpose documents. I think the record in this case shows pretty much exactly the opposite of what a lot of primary purpose cases show. What this case shows is that this document was prepared for the primary purpose of an investigation, and it was stored in the A files for the secondary purpose of future possible immigration consequences. And it's a little hard to parse this record together, but let me tell you why I think that's what the record demonstrates. This is not a routine affidavit. Mr. Durbin referred you to some internet sites and to some CFRs about routine immigration affidavits. Those are affidavits that are called for by the CFRs. They're taken in conjunction with applications for citizenship, for applications for passports, and they're called for. This affidavit is not mentioned in those sources. It's not mentioned in the adjudication manual. It's not mentioned in the CFRs. The government's immigration witness, Ms. Flores, took the stand, and she said, I've never seen an affidavit like this before. I don't recognize it. Yeah, it would be relevant. Of course it would be relevant to immigration considerations, but I don't recognize this affidavit. And when she was at, what the prosecutor ended up asking her was, is this the kind of affidavit that's normally kept in defendants' files regarding defendants' affidavits? And she said yes, which pretty much puts us right in Justice Scalia's language in Melendez-Diaz, where he says, look, if it's prepared for trial, and you go all the way back to Palmer in 1946, if it's prepared for trial, it doesn't matter what you call it. You can call it a business record. It doesn't matter where you store it. You can store it in the A file if you want. But if it was primarily prepared to preserve testimony, then it's a testimonial document. And so I think this is a relatively easy case, even under the primary purpose analysis, because it's clear that that was, in fact, the primary purpose. And, you know, Bryant tells us, I think we're a little confused about from whose perspective we're going to look at, you know, is
Can
it
I ask,
that...
I mean, obviously, in spite of it maybe appearing to be an easy case, the Supreme Court has wrestled since Crawford with what's testimonial or not. So it's a difficult issue.
It is.
And my question to you is, why are we addressing the constitutional question? If this document can't come in as a business record, which is what it was offered for, why go any further than that?
You could decide this on the hearsay document.
They offered it as a business record.
It was offered as a business record.
And this is not a business record in terms of something kept contemporaneous, regular course of business, not describing outsider statements, right?
In my view, it is absolutely not a business record. And, you know, as I look at this record, I'll be perfectly frank with you, I'm not sure we preserved. We did argue that it wasn't a business record, but it was in the context of our constitutional objection. I think our constitutional objection was made more strongly. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the two analyses after Crawford, this may be changing, but it hasn't yet, are uncoupled, right? They're not
right.
The same.
You always do both in court.
Exactly. So it can absolutely – we can win this absolutely at the hearsay question.
But then they have their secondary argument, which is even if wrong as a matter of admissibility, it's harmless.
It's harmless. And I'm happy to address that if – but I want to go back to, I just want to touch very quickly on the easy question. Crawford's in flux, and, you know, I thought I knew Crawford really well, and then the court decided Williams. And so, but here's what's not in flux. If this case right now were to go to the Supreme Court, four justices would say, we're going to look at the primary purpose and see if it's testimonial. Another four justices, the four justices who wrote what we call the plurality in Williams, they would say, yeah, we're going to look at the primary purpose, but we're going to look at whether it's against a targeted individual. So eight primary purpose, four targeted individual. One justice, Justice Thomas, has a single test, and that test is this sworn testimony, right?
So you say you win if you put Alito with Thomas, but you agree you lose.
I win if I put Thomas with the dissenters in Williams. So the dissenters say primary purpose only, plus Thomas,
right,
affidavit.
Okay. Alito said had to be targeted?
Alito said it had to be a targeted individual.
Okay. And you would lose under that?
Yes, and five justices have absolutely specifically...
It has to be this targeted, they say this targeted defendant, not a co-defendant.
Four justices say this targeted defendant, it cannot possibly be correct.
That's hard to harmonize with the text of the Sixth Amendment itself.
Which talks about witnesses at trial against the accused. And what Bull Cummings says is, once the state decided to put this expert on the stand, she became a witness against the defendant. And that's when our objection...
Why did the district judge below think Bull Cummings was so favorable to admissibility?
It
seems like the opposite.
I honestly believe it's a confusing record and there's so much arguing going on, but I honestly believe at that moment she just mischaracterizes both Melendez-Diaz and Bull Cummings, both on the question of business records and how controlling that inquiry is, and also on the question of whether it has to be a targeted individual. I think Bull Cummings is clear it doesn't. Melendez-Diaz comes very close to saying it doesn't. And then the five justices in Williams.
If the grandmother had said this about family history to some other family member, you wouldn't be able to make the argument you're making.
Absolutely correct. Absolutely correct. Yes.
Moving on to the harmless error, who had the burden of proof on the defense?
It is as it stands now in this court, is an element of the offense. The government had the burden. At the N-600 hearing where my client appeared, he had the burden. We're in very different postures as far as what the possible effect of this affidavit would have been, because it was the government's burden to prove. And I think it's worth mentioning, of course, we didn't get a hung jury, but we did get a deadlock note. And so the jury was thinking about these things.
Oh, you got a note accompanying the deadlock?
Well, no, we just got a note saying that the jury had been deadlocked. And I don't know what that note says. The court did not make it part of the record. But she did make clear that jury had deadlocked.
In your brief, you say that there was proof that Maria Caldera attended school in the United States in 1947.
Mm-hmm.
Where does that get you?
Well, what we're working on is reasonable doubt. So what we have is this family had intimate contacts with the United States from probably before 1947, but from at least 1947 forward. Maria attended school in the United States. Jose was born in the United States. And, you know, there was a lot of talk at trial, and this is true, that there's a whole bunch of fluidity at that border, right? And so it could be, right? The jury could have found that.
Well, Maria says she came to the United States in 1960.
Maria says a couple of things. Maria is responding to what looks to me like a pretty targeted question. When did you appear at the border? It could very easily be read to ask, when did you appear at the border in connection with the citizenship application? For example, it asks, how did you get here? Have you gone back to Mexico since you got here? So I think it could be read to be very targeted. And this is important, Jose, Maria's brother, who was born in 1947 when Maria was five, his birth certificate is a United States birth certificate. But it's more than that. And I regret that I didn't point this out in my brief. The birth certificate lists the residence of both of his parents as Eagle Pass, United States. And it gives a street address. So something's going on in these documents.
What year was that?
That was 1947 when Maria was 5 years
old. Again, 47. I mean.
Right. So what we have to show is that Maria had 10 years in the United States. Five of them have to be after 1955. Okay. So What we have evidence of is that family was living in the United States in 1947. Maria went to school in the United States in 1947. One of the daughters, Francesca, was baptized in the United States. Let me get the date on that for you, 1952. And Dad, Asensio, was working in the United States from 1955 through 1960. So the question is, do we have enough here to raise reasonable doubt about whether the government proved that Maria did not meet citizenship requirements? The government had evidence. The government had evidence, and I'm not here not to say it didn't. You know, really strong evidence. It had an N-600 denial against Mr. Duran. But we had evidence, too. And the question is, was there reasonable doubt? Grandma says we all came over in 1960, right? We weren't there before that. Our documents suggest otherwise, Jose's birth certificate being the strongest of those documents, with a street address in Eagle Pass. So does the fact that my client did not get to cross-examine his grandmother, and I know this is temporally kind of weird, but does the chance that the fact that my client didn't get to cross-examine his grandmother about the real discrepancies in this record and about who was dissembling on behalf of whom and in what direction could very well have had a material effect on the jury's verdict?
Did the grandmother's statement come up in the government's closing?
Yes, thank you for asking, because I want to point this court to a case, Justice Higginbotham, I believe you were on this panel. The name is Alvarado Valdez, and in that case, the court looked at a different kind of confrontation clause error, but it found controlling on the question of harm that the prosecutor in closing argument said, look, this document that it was okay to admit is consistent with this other document that violated the confrontation clause to admit. The court found that dispositive on the question of harm. And I have the citation for that case. And while I'm doing that, okay, so it's 521 F3rd 337. And then the other thing I want to mention about the government's closing argument is it sort of couples harm and testimonial together. The government said, you should trust Grandma's statement because it was sworn. Look, we have a sworn statement here, a sworn statement that you should trust.
Is there a challenge to the whether this is hearsay or not?
Counsel argued that it was not a business record. It is not the cleanest objection. In other words, it was made in the context of a confrontation clause argument.
I think an objection to confrontation may well protect an argument that it's hearsay. Suppose we just conclude this is just inadmissible hearsay, prejudicial.
You can absolutely stop right there.
You didn't preserve that.
I mean, hearsay is still the law.
Hearsay is still the law. It is not what I argued in the brief. I think the confrontation clause argument is solid.
I really do. I know, but it is, you know. What's the case on pending cert on dual purpose?
I do not know the name of it. I just got the email. I'd be happy to send a letter to the court and let you know.
What's the relief you asked for?
We should get a new trial.
With motion in limine then granted.
Exactly. Affidavit comes out.
Wasn't there another document that was not quite as conclusively?
Mom's citizenship application would still come in.
It would. That's not a Crawford issue.
I think we have a hearsay argument. We lost the hearsay argument. My guess is it's coming back in as a business record, I think, under this court's precedent. I want to say on the dual purpose question, no matter how that dual purpose case comes out in the Supreme Court, we do not have a record for a primary purpose as an immigration document. We just don't have that record. There are no questions. Save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court. Richard Durbin for the United States. They've got a good argument, and we have a tough case.
Mr. Durbin, why was this document put into evidence?
The document was put into evidence because the defense raised very early on the issue or the question of alienage. We had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant was an alien. The defense did not put on an affirmative defense in the sense of he was a citizen.
What was the relevance of this document?
The relevance of this document was to whether or not the defendant derived citizenship from his mother's citizenship. And under the statute, in order for him to have derived citizenship, she had to reside in the United States during certain periods of time.
So and why wasn't it hearsay?
It was admitted by the district court.
Admitted by what?
It was admitted by the district court as a business, under the business records exception.
I understand that. It doesn't look to me like it's a business record. I didn't see approval for it. I read the transcript.
Why it would not be hearsay, and it hasn't been raised by, it wasn't raised below, but it's arguably admissible under Rule 804.
Well, I think if you argue non-confrontation in this context, implicit in that is the underlying, so the subsidiary issue, if you will, of hearsay. What the Supreme Court has done, of course, with the confrontation clause is say that in some cases hearsay admissions can also affect the denial of rights, can be testimonial and be rights of constitutional. We don't have to, it's not a habeas case, it's a direct appeal. We're still looking at rules of evidence. Why should we go into all this head counting of the Supreme Court? Sorry, it's a hearsay, and it's plainly and enormously, it's plainly has punch in this case. Prejudicial to the defendants. I mean, it just does. You got a jury. What the first vote with the jury was 8-4 for not guilty. They went back out and deliberated again. They finally convicted.
But we don't know if that's what the jury's problem is.
All I'm saying is that all we do know is that the jury was having trouble with the case. And that's established.
But I don't know if the jury had trouble with the case because he had lived in the United States since he was 16. He had lived in the United States since he was 16, the defendant had. He spoke English. His life basically was here in the United States. For all I know, there were four jurors on that panel that said, nah, we don't want to do this to him. He's basically an American. I don't know what the jury
did. No, we don't know what the jury. I'm not suggesting we know what the jury did. I'm suggesting what we do know is that the jury had difficulty with the case. And we know that this particular piece of evidence was on its face directly relevant to this case. We started off with you telling me the relevance of it, and I'm going to come back to that. That's what I'm coming back to. It is relevant. It's more than relevant. It's very powerful stuff.
It's relevant, but the question
is... It's the sweet little grandmother down in Mexico pouring them out.
Well, the question, though, is did it substantially affect, or is it possible that this affected the jury's determination?
What was the closing argument? Any reference to any of this stuff?
The closing argument specifically referenced the affidavit.
My allergies are up and my hearing is down.
I'm with you, Judge. San Antonio this time of year.
So the framework that we've discussed, at least, is there are three ways to approach this. One is constitutional avoidance. We decide if it comes in. Second is hit the merits hard with the recency targeted angle. I think it's a really interesting case, but it's tough for you. Or finally, kick it out on harmlessness. Those are the three options.
I think those are the three options.
Now, the problem, even though I mentioned the first one, and I'd be tempted by avoidance, is I do think it probably comes in under 803 as a family history or 804 as an ancient record.
No one discussed it. I looked at the rule yesterday, and as I looked at Rule 8, I think it's 804. It's where the declarant's unavailable, and it's a statement of family history by someone in a position to know. That's an exception to the hearsay rule. And that has indicia of reliability. And the curious thing about the Supreme Court cases, especially if you look at Bryant, and that's what the district court relied on, except she was relying on, if I recall correctly, she was relying on Kennedy's concurrence. And Kennedy's concurrence is the opinion that sets forth the notion of, well, this wasn't targeted toward the individual, like Sir Walter Raleigh's trial. Those were statements that were obtained specifically targeting him.
On the merits, then, the recency issue doesn't apply, right? If you got this statement from the grandmother yesterday and then you offered it in court as a paper witness, that would be unacceptable unless we turn this on targeting.
I think that's right. I mean, the irony of this is if the grandmother testified in a trial under oath 45 years ago.
The grandmother testified?
I say if.
Okay.
Hypothetically, suppose that she had testified in a trial of whoever it was that was tried, and it's not clear from the record.
It's still a hearsay, but
it doesn't come in.
But you wouldn't have a confrontational problem.
I don't. Why? I think we. I'm not sure it would come in.
Because the witnesses on the stand, that prior statement may not. It doesn't relieve its hearsay character.
I think that's right. I mean, I think it doesn't come in.
It's a misconception.
But and because this is an affidavit, and it's sworn, well, it would seem to fall within Crawford. So as you posit, well, if she had, by circumstance, said it to somebody else who was not an immigration officer, it was just a family member, it would have all come in. And isn't the question ultimately the reliability of it?
No. Well, I mean, Crawford tosses out the reliability test.
Well, it does sort of, but
I think it pretty much does completely.
Justice Sotomayor brings it back in, and so does the court in Davis when they talk about, well, but there is an exception to the application of Crawford in statements to police where there is some ongoing emergency because.
Well, that's because a 9/11 call is a lot less like a formalized solemnity. Right. A 9/11 is the spontaneous thing where you can argue it's not testimonial because the person's just calling for
it's
help.
It's like an excited utterance.
But
is
this
what the
is
court
the opposite.
Said.
This is what even dissenters are talking about. This is the formalized solemnity of a paper witness. So, I mean, I think you agree this is a tough one.
I don't disagree that this is a tough one. I'd rather have their side. But this is where I am today.
Well, which is OK. I guess, are you agreeing that on the evidence rules, it's not a business record? Or do you not want to agree that?
I have a hard time making this. I don't find the record quite as clear as Ms. Coulthart did, but I don't think that helps us particularly. The parties in the court knew something about the provenance of this affidavit that I can't find in the record. I don't know what it was taken for.
And her answer, citing our case law, is that it is the government's burden.
It is.
It is, to prove the context. Jack.
And the foundation for this, I mean, there's a lot of argument and talk back and forth with the court leading up. I mean, it starts before jury selection. They start talking about this.
May I ask, I mean, and I appreciate all your candor, is the position you're arguing on Crawford here one that is consistent with the position the government's taking at the highest court these days?
I don't know the answer.
On the target, you don't know the answer.
I don't know the answer.
It's hard.
This is very different. I mean, they've made a hash out of this stuff.
I think, though, and I don't mean to jump ahead, but the harmlessness is difficult in a deadlocked jury case where the item is brought up in closing. Those are hard to say harmless.
It's very hard to say harmless, and the court will have to take a look at it. I mean, the evidence that the defendant put in, I would submit, is not persuasive of residents. I mean, as Ms. Coulthart pointed out, we're dealing with a border. There's a lot of going back and forth. There's an affidavit, for example, that came in of some gentleman named Richie in Crystal City who purportedly hired the grandfather for 10 years. But that doesn't mean that he resided in the United States during that 10-year period of time. It doesn't mean that his family resided in the United States during that period.
A-files become these huge sucking vacuums.
They're enormous.
Who knows what you're going to find?
They've got all kinds of stuff in there. And the mother's application, her N-600 or whatever it was at the time, I mean, she indicated she didn't come to the United States until 1960. That is in her application for a certificate of citizenship, and she didn't get the certificate until 1972, and I submit that was
on the merits. To the extent anyone can decipher Williams, would you agree with the characterization opposing counsel gave to it that you win under Alito with four, but you don't win if we count Thomas with the other four?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, that's the way I see it. Is you've got four justices that are looking at this notion of if it's not a targeted individual, then it doesn't fall within Crawford. You've got four that disagree, and Thomas is sitting out there saying, well, all that matters is whether or not it was sworn to.
And this was.
Which was sworn to. Unless there are further questions, I'll give you back the rest of my time.
No, thank you.
Thank you.
I'll be very brief. I'm glad I didn't say 804. I think that is the problem on this document as a hearsay matter.
I'm sorry. So you agree that it would probably come in?
We would litigate it.
You would litigate it?
We would litigate it.
What's
we would litigate it, but I think ancient documents, far as just plain hearsay, I think ancient documents would be where we might litigate.
Exception.
Yeah, I'm sorry, 803.
But 804 is the family history. And that requires some authenticity.
I thought that was a judgment.
Right. And I'm not sure about family history because, I mean, this is so plainly an investigatory document.
What are you agreeing to?
I'm merely saying that we would not have a slam dead winner on remand about whether this document comes in as a matter of hearsay. As a matter of confrontation, I don't think it comes in.
So for us to just send it back saying you got it wrong on business records, probably confrontation clause has to be dealt with because then they turn around and say, well, we offer it as a family history or an ancient record.
I fear that we would be litigating.
I thought your
yes.
objection at trial was that this was testimonial. Hearsay.
We argued.
You used the word hearsay.
That's right. We argued it was testimonial hearsay.
And now you're going
we did use that word.
You're going to concede that this is not hearsay?
I am not conceding anything. I'm saying that we would litigate it.
Well,
you said in the prior
argument. I'm not representing your client, but I hope you are.
No. We will litigate it. You said in the prior argument that defense counsel will say what's best for a defendant, and we will.
Well, now, just a little bit.
I'm sorry.
I don't mean to get you excited. Just answer my question slowly so I can understand.
I am not making a concession on admissibility. We will litigate admissibility. I'm only saying that it will probably be litigated.
It would probably what?
Be litigated. Hearsay would probably be litigated if it went back.
But if, I mean, I don't just mean to be, and I do get excited myself, so, but it's relevant to get to the bottom of this dialogue because if this didn't have a confrontation clause element and it was coming up to us as hearsay, we could affirm on any evidentiary basis.
Absolutely.
So we wouldn't just remand because business records don't apply. We would have to ourselves say, what about ancient records? What about medical history? So we probably have to wrestle through this. So it's important for us to ask you the question. You're telling us you don't concede that it coming in under either of those?
Absolutely
right.
Not.
You're just being candid that it looks like it might, more than a business record.
It looks like we would have to fight it out. That's exactly right. Certainly much more than a business record.
Yeah.
I don't see it as a family document. It's just so clearly investigatory in intent. As far as reliability, Justice Sotomayor is kind of messing around with that notion, but I think, Justice Higginson, your point was very well taken, not in a case like this, not in a case where we have to try to figure out where especially an oral statement, fits in this primary purpose. When you've got a clearly testimonial document such as this one, it's for the jury to decide whether it's reliable. That's what Crawford says the Confrontation Clause guarantees, is a jury finding of reliability. So the debate about how good our evidence is was really a debate that the jury should have had.
This case would test the Williams split because the point about targeting is almost as powerful as it could ever be in a case like this because there's no way the grandmother was targeting her 6-year-old son or grandson.
This case would put, if the court decided to take it, given the posture of the count, this court would make somebody say one, well, it might not, because if Thomas agreed with our position and concurred based on affidavit, then they could avoid it again. They could avoid it again. I'm sorry, one more thing about why the jury did what it did. The only issue before the court was whether our client was an alien. It's the only thing we litigated was whether or not the government had proved his citizenship. So I think at least a fair inference, given that it's the government's burden, is that that's where they were hung up. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel.